from Steve Kraske. Fat. We don't like how it looks, but we sure like how it tastes. That's a fancy way of saying that our love-hate relationship with fat dates back a long, long way. Our guest today says that we are more obsessed today with fat than we have been in the past. Today, a conversation about our society's perception of fat and our obsession with weight loss and how fat has been viewed throughout the ages. Our guest today is KU history professor Christopher Forth, who's writing a book on all this titled Flab, A Cultural History of Fat. He joins us this morning from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. And Chris, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning to you, and thanks for having me.
Well, Professor, you're writing a book on this topic, and you've written several papers about fat, or flab, I guess as you call it. So I'm wondering, why so much interest in fat?
I mean, today.
Today, sure.
Well, today, obviously, it's a matter of, I think many people point to aesthetics and beauty issues. It comes down to matters of health. It becomes matters of public finances, the ability to fund people and through Medicare and programs like that. But I think that it also comes down to concerns about aging. I think it comes down to concerns about preserving youthfulness and a sense of vitality and how the body performs. And I think with all of these things coming together by the late 20th and early 21st centuries, I think fat becomes targeted for a variety of different reasons, many of which are new and some of which are, I think, really quite old.
But why do you have so much interest in fat yourself, Chris?
Some of it, I think, came out of early research I was doing on masculinity, mostly looking at France in the 19th century. And it became, you know, odd to me to notice that a lot of prejudice and invective was being leveled against particular fat men in France, which I thought was odd because I was always under the impression that fat is, as they say, a feminist issue, something that really pertains to women and beauty ideals and things like that. And so I became quite intrigued when I saw that men were being targeted in different ways. And it wasn't so much about their beauty or their appearance. It was a matter of how their fat seemed to, in the eyes of those who were criticizing them, seem to symbolize their own negative qualities, usually qualities of softness, of weakness, of malleability, of undependability, and the list of negative terms goes on and on, all of which seem to be concretized in their fat bodies. And this was very intriguing to me. It suggested that fat was not simply a matter of appearance, but about character. Huh. And that this sense of a kind of inner soft character could be legible in a sense in a soft body. And that became very, very intriguing to me.
You mentioned France. You mentioned fat. And you do write in your papers about something called the Paris fat trade. What was the Paris fat trade? Because this was so interesting to me.
Oh, yes. This was this was a bit odd. But it relates – before I discuss that, it relates to the ways in which I started to think about fat since beginning this work on softness, because fat, I discovered, was not merely a matter of the size and shape of the body, but it also referred to the substance that makes the body look as it does when there's too much fat accumulated within it. And so I started to become very concerned about, well, fat outside of the body, in the sense of oil, in the sense of animal fat, in the sense of greasy things generally. Because for me, this became the way in which, you know, I thought that, you know, when people say that they are disgusted about fat, I thought that wasn't primarily about how they looked. It was actually about how they felt and about – it made references to this stuff inside the body. This the Paris fat trade, which was probably short-lived, but it came to light in the early 19th century as it was discovered that a number of medical interns who were working in the dissecting rooms of Paris were actually taking the fat out of the cadavers and then taking it home and storing it and then selling it to people. And they were selling it to medical charlatans because – and I could talk about this later – there's a longstanding belief in the West that fat has certain curative properties, particularly human fat. But they were also by this point selling it to the manufacturers of fake pearls, for example, and enamelists, people who would, you know, apply enamel to furniture, who claimed that, oh, they thought that they were getting dog fat or horse fat. And so there's all this minor controversy that was mostly covered up. But that's a kind of – that's a fairly recent example of a fat trade that goes back centuries. If you go back to the early 16th century, you can see this kind of thing happening already. When executed criminals were cut down from the gallows or wherever, the executioner usually got their corpse. And the executioner mm-hmm. would be the one who would cut out the fat and start selling it to people who believe that the fat had these kind of vital properties within it.
That's just
and
amazing.
So fatness and fat is sort of possesses these qualities, which is really quite interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, with some of these guys, these medical workers in Paris you write about, they didn't have just a little bit of fat in their homes. They had jars and jars and jars of it, right?
Well, yeah, one was caught with 2,000 liters of it, which I think would have smelled after a while.
You would think. You would think. Well, I'm wondering about American society's perception of fat and if you think that's unhealthy too.
Well, yeah, I do. I think particularly because it is so – it's not just American. If you actually look at French attitudes towards fat today, it may actually be even worse. I think it's actually really bad to be fat in France. In America, I think it's quite unhealthy because it's really quite – it's quite hateful. A number of people involved with what's sometimes called fat activism or size acceptance movement, I think rightly point out that whereas you really can't get away with being in a mainstream way racist or homophobic or sexist, you can often get away with being really quite hateful to fat people for reasons that in many cases are really not their fault. But I think in America we tend to focus very much upon the role of the individual to take command of her or his life. Mm-hmm. And so that any kind of infraction like this, whether it's beauty or health related, is seen as really resting squarely on the shoulders of the person involved. And I think that ignores all kinds of sociological and economic realities in the U.S. today.
Hey, do you see our perceptions of folks who are overweight changing at all, Chris, or is it sort of staying the same?
Well, that depends on who you're talking to.
Sure.
If I look at television shows and movies, you see, I think, a kind of normalization of fat bodies in the sense that you'll see more fat characters in the media. But the problem is, I think that this kind of relaxation or normalization of fat people is really taking place more with men than it is with women. There are certain movies that you can point to where there's a chubby but lovable comedic actor
yeah.
who's playing a role, and we're supposed to sympathize with him, and yet he almost always gets a fairly slender, svelte, beautiful woman at the end, and we feel that's a good thing, that we've overcome our prejudice. But there are films that you can – and shows that you can – TV shows you can point to where this kind of latitude, this kind of understanding is never really accorded to fat women. And that to that extent, I think that there definitely is a gender divide when it comes to these kinds of perceptions.
And
we're easier on fat men than we are on fat women.
And that's not changing?
Not very much, no.
Yeah. Let's get our listeners involved here. Why is our society so hung up on fat, and what would it take to change it? Why are we so obsessed with obesity, and why are we obsessed with thinness? Our phone number here today, 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. But, as you point out, Chris, societies going back centuries have also been concerned about fat. Is it safe to say, though, that that they haven't been as concerned about it as we are these days?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think there's a number of scholars have argued, and I largely agree with them, that we really started to become particularly concerned about appearances in the West from about the 16th century onward, which is not to say that appearance didn't matter in previous centuries. It certainly did. But I think our obsessions with appearance and the idea that we must take personal responsibility for mm-hmm. our appearance, that's actually mm-hmm. kind of a duty that we must have to please others to some extent, I think that's definitely quite a modern phenomenon. But the problem is that many people have acknowledged that. Then they've assumed that, well, what happened prior to, say, the early modern period, like the medieval and the ancient world, was really inconsequential for fatness, that one could be fat without any kind of without raising any kind of eyebrows, that it was – and some will go so far as to say that it was an unmitigated good, that it was sexy, it was desirable. And this is really does not backed up by the historical material that I've been looking at all.
Mm-hmm. So how did it come to pass then that this – country became so obsessed not only with fat folks, but the opposite of fat, which is being so skinny with no fat at all.
Yeah, that phenomenon is I would trace that to the end of the 19th and the early 20th century. By the 1920s, you have a very strong focus on women in particular being especially slender. But the thing to keep in mind is that today we talk about thin and fat, and we really acknowledge no middle ground. But there had been a middle ground in the West going back to antiquity, which was the moderate body. Throughout the 19th century, bodies, particularly women's bodies, were meant to be moderate, neither too thin nor too fat, which is the idea of the French term en bon point. You're in the right form, right in between. And we've lost that sense of moderation, I think, so that somebody who, to my eyes, looks moderate, average, they may feel at any given day that they've simply become fat. And they may be viewed simply as fat. And so fat, to some extent, becomes almost – and one scholar put this almost like pornography, as the Chief Justice had put it years ago. You really can't define it except when it's very, very extreme. But you know it when you see it. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is a very unreliable way of approaching the fat.
And what is it in our society that's driving this sort of obsession towards Twiggy a number of years ago, folks who are just almost scary thin?
Well, I think part of it has to do with a fear of aging and a fear of death. Some people have written about the denial of death in the 20th century. This is a phenomenon, that you can see across the Western world. But I do think that when we get to the point where we associate taking on weight as a kind of decay of the body, and this is where this idea of softness, I think, becomes really quite relevant, because the soft is, can be viewed as that which is rotten, that which is putrefying and decomposing. And to some extent, there is a sense that taking on too much fat is a sign of that. But there's also a sense in which the body in the 20th century has come to be viewed as machine-like. There's a very strong emphasis, particularly in American – or Anglo-American, but particularly American culture, on efficiency and on performance. And we started to, around the 1920s, 1930s, use machine imagery to describe the ways in which bodies should function. And fat became viewed as something that was simply inefficient. It was inefficient in the sense that it got in the way of your body's ability to be mobile, to be fast, to be performative. But it was also inefficient in that it suggested that the body as a machine was taking in more than it could actually use. And so fat became viewed as a kind of waste. And this is one way in which you can think about how when people sometimes describe fat as something almost excremental, they are describing it in terms of a kind of waste, whether it's human or animal waste or industrial waste. And so this image of the body as a kind of machine, as something that we like to think of as being, with technological intervention, eternally youthful, this, I think, plays a significant role in all of this.
We're talking with KU history professor Christopher Forth about fat. He's written about this in a number of papers. He's working on a book titled Flab, A Cultural History of Fat. Why are we so obsessed with obesity in this country, and are we making progress with how we view women who might be carrying a few extra pounds or not? 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date at kcur.org. Manuel from Kansas City, Missouri, you're around with Chris Forth. Good morning.
Good morning. I just had a comment. As a man, I have a very hard time gaining weight. And I'm actually kind of underweight for my height. I'm 6'6", and I'm just under 150 pounds. And I'm on a high-calorie, high-protein diet, and I always feel very self-conscious about this. I'm getting 3,000 plus calories a day and not really able to gain any weight. But I still, it does work both ways. I feel conscious about being rather slender and kind of skinny,
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. And if you look at, I don't know if the Charles Atlas ads, if you remember, these from comic books where, you can have a body like this bodybuilder.
One
of the things in the early days of that movement, they tended to focus more on bulking up men and boys. and less on actually, you know, shedding weight. So this sense that one needs to bulk up the body through muscularity, not so much through fat, they wouldn't have wanted that, but to put muscle on becomes, I think, a fairly important thing for males. I think the fact is that extreme slenderness and extreme fatness have historically always been viewed as problematic. And even today, even though I think women's bodies are expected to be especially thin, we don't really look upon anorexics as being sexy or beautiful. You know, once you start to get skeletal, that's going over into, I think, a kind of reminder of death that most people are really not very comfortable with. But I know what you're saying. When it comes to masculinity, a body sort of fit, the sort of what's called the mesomorphic body, in between extremes, is usually considered to be the ideal, which most people don't actually approximate.
Manuel, thanks for the phone call.
Well, thank you.
You bet.
Yeah.
Take care. Bye-bye. Let's go to Gary from Overland Park. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. What's driving with our obsession in our society with obesity? What's driving our obsession with thinness? Again, 816-235-2888. Gary from Overland Park, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. Nothing against, overweight people, but what about the issue of health care? And I feel like that normal thin person like myself is subsidizing people that won't exercise, don't exercise, are heavy. I don't get any benefit or a better rate because I keep myself in shape. So it's not so much a prejudice. It's like, we're always talking about the rising cost of health care. I know people that have adult onset diabetes because of their weight, and yet they take pills instead of try to lose weight. It's the whole thing. It's supporting the drug companies. The cost of prescription medications absurd. The health care just never ending going up. So what about that issue? How does that play into it?
Yeah.
I'll take my answer up here.
Thanks, Gary.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. That's an important issue, and it's the kind of thing that when you look at this globally, that issue is raised in Australia, New Zealand, in Britain, in France, et cetera, places where they have actually much more developed public healthcare models than we do. I think that for a lot of people who are involved in fat activism and what's sometimes called fat studies, it's a matter of whether the emphasis on slenderness, or at least on a moderate body, is really about health at all, or whether it's about other kinds of issues pertaining to, for example, aesthetics and disgust. Although I know exactly what you mean, because most of these scholars and activists will admit that when you get into extreme levels of fatness, that clearly are health issues. But for many people, I think it's really not there at all. There's a movement called Health at Any Size, which tries to emphasize the fact that one can actually be and actually have a large body, but be actually healthy on many different levels. For example, the body mass index is widely criticized as being a completely unreliable measure of actual physical fitness and health. And this is something that I don't think has really trickled down very much to GPs, who tend to refer to it constantly. There are a lot of studies I've read where, the objective data about one's health in terms of heart rate and caloric intake and cholesterol levels is really irrelevant to people who assume that fatness automatically equals unhealthiness. And so while I agree with the sentiment, I think that it's a little bit more complicated than the way in which many people present it.
Okay. Let's go to Tracy from Lake Wacomas. Tracy, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Tracy.
Okay. I just wanted to exactly what he was just saying. I am a woman now who is between 190 and 200 pounds and in my 50s. I work longer and harder than all of the youth that I employ. I have endurance beyond all of them, and I have a very, well and stable health history. However, when I was younger, I was very, very, very skinny. And then I noticed that the men would paw, and it was just not a comfortable feeling. I was very skinny because I was hungry. I had to support myself, and I never knew where my next meal was going to come from. So here at a comfortable state in my life, I really enjoy exactly where I am. However, I have had bosses in the past who have tried to encourage me to lose weight because they think I'm fat. I have been shunned in interviews because of my weight, and I hear it all the time from the public, fat woman, comments like that. Well, they can say what they want. I can outdo any of them, and if it came to hand-to-hand combat, they would be the ones that went down and not me. So I am really comfortable with where I am, and I want to stay here. I don't have to worry about the next meal coming because I know I've got enough padding that would carry me through if I had a hunger period.
Yeah. Well, Tracy, you go, girl. I'm glad to have your phone call.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye. Let's go to Misty from Kansas City, Missouri. Misty, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I just like to say that I'm a runner, and one of the most affirming things I see is when I watch the Olympics, I become inspired by all the different body types that are healthy. You know, Jamaican sprinters versus American basketball players, or shot putters versus long-distance runners. The spectrum of healthy is, I think, a lot larger than we realize. And that's really all I'd like to say is it's magnificent to me to see so many different cultures and backgrounds and shapes and sizes of people competing at the utmost.
Misty, that's a great call, and I really appreciate it. Let's go back to the history books, Chris. How did the ancient Greeks, you know, and the Romans and the Hebrews feel about fat?
That's actually kind of a complicated question.
Mm-hmm.
Because for them, fat wasn't just something in the body. When they thought about fat, they were thinking about fatness and fatty things, and by which I mean sticky things. Things that are a bit viscous. So there's, for example, there's an old metaphor that people sometimes refer to today. They refer to the fat of the land, which I had thought for years was just a metaphor, you know, a symbol of, you know, bounty and fertility and abundance and all of that. But in fact, what they meant was they were actually meant that quite literally. They meant that there's something literally greasy about soil that's fertile. So that you can actually tell by picking it up and holding it in your hand, if it sticks together, this is a sign of fat soil. The reason I'm mentioning this is that for the Greeks and Romans and for the Hebrews, they when they thought about bodies, they also thought about them in reference to agricultural imagery. Not only the reference to crops, but also reference to animals that would, you know, can become fattened for the slaughter, for example, or become fattened, you know, to be made healthy or whatever. But in each of these cases, this fatness, this fertility, this abundance was seen as a point on a continuum. So that fat soil is good as long as it's moderate. Excessively fat soil, just as excessively fat animals, were typically seen as being not fertile. Barren, sterile, and even to the point of decay. So that even they acknowledge that a certain degree of fatness is wonderful, and you should seek it out because it's enjoyable, and you can do things with it. But for them, this is where the concept of the moderate body, I think, you know, really comes from, because it's a classical ideal, and the best fat is that which is in between the extremes of extreme slenderness and extreme fatness, neither of which are seen as being especially good.
Well, then how do residents of Africa and Asia now regard extra weight, and how does that differ from how Western countries feel about it, Chris?
That depends on today. If you're talking about today, it depends on where they're living and exactly how much exposure they have to either traditional ideas of their own country or to Western ideas about fat, because I think in the urban dwellers in Africa will certainly have access to Western perceptions. They certainly have access to this when it comes to skin color, so that skin lighteners, for example, are extremely popular in Africa. And I do think that traditional ideas about corpulence as being symbols of fertility and even a kind of male power in the cities would be considered to be, you know, not modern, not civilized, and many people might actually be working their bodies to approximate Western ideals. However, in traditional cultures, and here I'm making a sweeping statement, but in many of these cultures, corpulence is a sign of definitely a fertility, a sign of beauty. Girls would typically be fattened up for marriage, force-fed, I should say, in many of these cultures.
Really?
And in certain African cultures, fat men were considered – their fat was a sign of like an accumulation of fluids in a sense, by which I mean things like semen. I mean, in many of these cultures, there's a connection between blood and semen and milk and fat. This is a connection that you would have also seen in ancient Greece and Rome. One was seen as a different version of the other, so that from at least a certain African perspective, the accumulation of fat in the body could be viewed as a kind of storing up of these other vital fluids.
But these attitudes are changing as folks in Africa become more exposed to Western culture. Are we going to see these attitudes fade away?
Well, again, I think it comes down to where they're living. If they have, if they're really in much more contact with traditional concepts, I think those traditional ideals will linger. But again, if they're connected to a global media, they're going to see new images of what the ideals should be, and there is obviously going to be, you know, people will start to change if they haven't already changed the way in which they view their own bodies.
Let's go to one more call before a break here. Aaron from Overland Park. Aaron, good morning.
Hi.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Okay, well, I was just going to touch on earlier you'd asked kind of just like why people seem so obsessed with being thin. And so for me, I'm in charge of two little kids under two and what they eat every day, and myself and my husband. So mm-hmm. I do all the grocery shopping and meal planning and such. And we're really into like organics, and obviously we all want to be thin and healthy and all that.
Right.
And I feel like the reason I have to stay kind of obsessed or like on my game about it is because there's so much temptation to do the wrong thing. It's like you go to the grocery store and 3/4 of it, I mean, the kids aisle is just like all, sugared drinks and Jell-O and things like that.
Yeah.
You're driving down the street and you can go pop into a McDonald's at any point. You go to a friend's house and they're offering your kid like chicken nuggets as a snack. And you're just constantly forced with, like, decision-making along those lines. So, I mean, that's why I feel like I'm kind of obsessed, borderline, if you will, but it's just, like, for the health of my family, because I feel like I'm tempted so much with bad choices.
Hmm. When did people start watching what they're eating, Chris?
They always have. I think mm-hmm. that people have... I mean, there have always been certain foods that have been recommended over others. There have always been certain foods that are considered to excite the passions, to calm the passions, to build strength, to relax one. And so I think in that basic general sense, that's always been something that people have done. When it comes to watching their diet for the purposes of weight loss, that too, I think, is quite old. If you go back to the Greek and Roman physicians who basically recommended all kinds of diets that would cause people to, if they were believed to be too fat, to slim down. I think it became very widespread sometime around the mid to the late 19th century in the West. Yeah. Where people became especially concerned about cutting the right kind of figure. And the reasons for that, I think, are really quite complicated. But to some extent, I mean, this is actually done against the backdrop of what other countries in the world are doing. For example, mm-hmm. in Africa and China and India, there was a sense in the West that I think gained momentum during the 19th century that if you really wanted to look white, if you wanted to look civilized, if you wanted to look like you were in control of yourself, you took your own appetites and your dietary intake in hand, and as well as your exercise regimen, but with an eye towards what these other people in the world were doing. There is really a kind of racial subtext to a lot of our views of fat by the time you get to the 20th century. I think it's still there today to some extent.
At what point did medical science begin to realize that fat may be associated with lack of good health?
Hippocrates. Go back to the Greeks.
All the way back.
Yeah. All the way back.
Okay. Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about fat with KU history professor Christopher Forth. We'll talk a little more about the science of fat and what it is exactly. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Monday on the program, the book doctors come back to tell us about some good books to read at end of summer, going into the fall. This hour, we're talking about fat with KU history professor Christopher Forth. We're talking about why we're so obsessed with it, the history of it, and how different cultures feel about fat. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Why are we so hung up on fat? Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Let's go to some phone calls here and go to Maggie from Blue Springs. Maggie, you're on with KU history professor Christopher Forth. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
My thought is that in some cases we're not obsessed with fat. When you're a senior age woman, that little bit of fat around the belly is, oh, it's always going to be there. We accept it. But to me, fat is fat. And I guess when I called initially, I said, talked about a muffin top. When you put a pair of slacks on or a pair of jeans and the fat pushes up and hangs over the edge, that's fat.
Has that always been the case, Chris?
We accept that fat.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Has what always been the case?
Has this notion of the muffin top always been sort of accepted or not?
Oh, well, you know, we wear far fewer clothes today than people did in previous times. I mean, there was a lot of layers that would have covered up, you know, the muffin top to the point where it would be, for all intents and purposes, invisible.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in the 20th century, as we've kind of overcome certain Victorian inhibitions about how much of the body can be revealed, we've revealed upper arms, we've revealed more of the leg, and obviously ankles. And with beach culture, you have an almost an expectation, really, to reveal more, at least during certain times of the year and in certain venues, so that and as you reveal more, that necessarily means that you become more self-conscious about what you're revealing and whether it corresponds to the dominant beauty ideals of the day. So fewer clothes in this case means more anxiety about what the body actually is.
Maggie, thank you for the call. Let's go to Randy from Kansas City, Missouri. Randy, you're on the air with Chris Forth. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just curious. I was kind of amazed at the success of the TV show Mike and Molly, which essentially deals with some rather large characters. And it was curious as to, you know, when I first saw the show, I thought I'd give it maybe a 6 weeks run and then it would be pulled off the air. But it's been quite successful. What is your opinion of why it's been successful? And how does that relate back to, say, earlier times with the paintings of large women? My wife worked in a clothing store that only sold large women's clothing, and they had all these rotund pictures. Can't remember the artist's name, but it seems like it was just displayed, and they were happy with it.
Mm-hmm. Randy, thank you. Yeah, what about that, Chris?
Yeah, I think that show is a good example of a normalization of fat for males and females, which actually seems to work. Yes. Now, whether or not it will be ultimately successful in rendering larger bodies acceptable, erotic, and beautiful, that I think remains to be seen. But certainly it taps into what for many people, at least in the U.S., has become more of a normal, you know, situation in relation to their bodies. Yeah.
It seems to me that there's always been a place for it. I mean, we talk about Mike and Molly. There was Roseanne. What about other portrayals of fat in the arts going back the last 4 or 5 decades, Chris?
Yeah, they tend to be, well, typically more comedic characters who can get away with that. And they can be buffoons. They can be grotesque. A show like Roseanne, though, is a little bit different because it really aims at capturing a kind of reality. I don't think it's lampooned in the same way. But I'm going back further now and thinking about Hollywood films. And I've done a bit of work on fat characters, particularly in crime films, and they can be viewed in usually in a variety of ways. In one way, if they're large, their fat will be imposing. It'll be – I'm thinking of men. Monumental, dangerous, threatening. But at the same time, the fat also suggests a kind of weakness, a kind of corruption, that they're soft. They are easily carried away by their appetites, whether they're appetites for food, for sex, or even for aggression. And so there is a sense of a kind of pathology wrapped up with many of these representations. And you certainly see that from the 1920s onward when really if you're going to be a hero or heroine in Hollywood films, slenderness is, you know, or at least some kind of level of moderation is considered to be absolutely essential.
You know, what is fat exactly, and how can it be good for us, and why is it bad for us from a scientific standpoint?
Well, this, to be honest, is not something I've looked at in any great detail.
Sure, sure.
Because I think lots of other people have done that. And all I can really probably say here is what I think people already know. I mean, there are issues of cholesterol. There are issues of respiration. There are issues of heart rate that in extreme cases are, you know, certainly to be addressed. But I think our fears about fat, which is really what I'm concerned about in the work I've been doing, really don't come down to that. It's really hard to hate somebody because you feel they have a different respiration or heart rate than you. That's not really what it comes down to. I don't think the disgust, which is the emotion usually attached to fat, has anything to do with medicine. I think it has to do with issues of aesthetics, issues of the qualities, the perceived qualities that we see in people who carry extra weight. And that's, for me, that's the main focus of what I'm looking at.
You know, and fat obviously still used in all kinds of products. How common is it out there in the marketplace?
It's extremely common, especially if you, expand your definition of fat to include oils. Shea oil, for example, is wildly popular, and this is a kind of – you have to consider that to be a kind of fat. Anything with butter in it is certainly fat. Cosmetics have fat in it. What's interesting about these products is when you start to think about the ways in which fat – like perceptions of fat as a substance have changed over time. We were talking earlier about the Parisian fat trade,
right,
and how there was a sense that there was something vital about human fat in particular. But what's interesting is if you look at in the 19th century at the history of modern chemistry, the rise of nutritional scientists. I'm thinking here of the work of the German scientist Liebig, Wilbur Atwater in the U.S. These are people who effectively, by breaking fat down into its components, rendered it dead in a way. They drained what earlier peoples had viewed as the vital properties of this substance down into merely its chemical components. And I think that played a significant role in how people started to view fat because it didn't seem to be filled with life anymore. It seemed to be merely a chemical or, worse, a harbinger of decay. And I think that that plays a very significant role in how we've come to, by the 20th century, really think about fat in fairly negative terms.
Tell us what St. Augustine said to his chubby patrons, Chris.
Yeah, Augustine is a very interesting case because like a lot of early Christians, he was very much informed by Greco-Roman ideas about morality, about luxury, and about filth, really. He was very concerned about that. And he was, in several points in his career, called upon to describe what would happen after the end of time, with the second coming, when people will get their bodies back. Because, you know, the resurrection of the body is obviously an important component of many versions of Christianity. And people were wondering, you know, well, I've, you know, I died with one arm gone. Will I have my arm back? You know, when, you know, I died and I'm really in bad shape. Will I come back, you know, in good shape? And they also were concerned about, you know, if they died too thin or too fat. And it was interesting because he argued that, and he does this finally at length in The City of God. He basically says that, well, you will come back exactly as you should have been. So that if you died too fat, it's going to be okay because you'll come back with your body from the way you were when you're in your 30s or, as he points out, the way you should have been, which I find really quite fascinating because if we think about, you know, the idealized body as being a fairly modern phenomenon, well, here's a guy thinking about what bodies are going to look like in the New Jerusalem. And for him, these bodies are going to be really easy on the eyes. And that is important because for him, virtue and holiness go with a certain kind of physique. And this is a very Greco-Roman concept that we've never really overcome, I would say, in the West. And there are even, you know, there are certain movements, particularly in the U.S., and I think this is particularly true among certain Protestant groups where I think there's one book that basically says that God hates fat, that fatness is actually a sin. Hmm. And that to show one's virtue, one's spirituality, one's holiness, one actually has to have a more slender body. But that – the roots of that – perception, which I think are really quite disturbing, frankly, are really quite ancient. And they certainly go back to, at the very least, Augustine. But I would say go back to the Greeks and the Romans who inspired him.
You also write that as recently as the 18th century, Chris, that Europeans were using human fat from cadavers for medicinal purposes. The practice led some to fear being murdered for their fat or even being attacked by witches or werewolves. Attacked by werewolves? I mean, what was that all about?
this goes back to this idea that fat, any kind of fat, possesses a kind of vitality. It's life, in a sense. And this is one reason why a lot of people have suggested that prior to, you know, the modern period, people really saw fat as just fertility, as beauty, as good, as a good thing. But the belief from the 16th century, and really this I think was in place through the 18th century, was that witches would use the fat of children to cut it out of their bodies to make an unguent, a sort of ointment that would allow them to fly. You rub it on your broomstick and off you go. There was also the belief this is among peasants in the French Alps. There was a fear that werewolves were also stealing the fat of people because the claim was that in addition to biting someone and turning them into a werewolf that way, there was an ointment that they used as if they were kind of swapping recipes with witches to turn people also into werewolves. But these kinds of things refer not so much to the substance itself, although they do, but it refers also to this idea that fat is something – to grow fat comes from eating and ingesting so that it's a matter of devouring, so that any local group who seems to, metaphorically speaking, devour another, whether through economic exploitation or through warfare, is described as growing fat off of them. And I think this is also wrapped up with the sense that what they're taking from you is your life itself.
Were people actually murdered for their fat? Are there any examples of that out there that you came across?
Oh, yeah. This was happening. It wasn't a widespread phenomenon, by the way, but it was happening in some Germanic countries and certainly in Russia around 1900, though the practice goes back several previous centuries. It was the practice of making what we call thieves' candles. These were candles sometimes made of a finger, but some often made out of human fat that you would burn. And you burn this, it was said, if you're a thief and you're going to break into someone's house. And as long as the thieves' candle was burning, that the occupants would continue to slumber, you'd be invisible, and you'd be able to do all this stuff. And so there were a number of thieves in German-speaking lands who were executed because they killed people to make these candles. Wow. And this is how deeply ingrained in many cultures this notion of the vitality or at least the almost magical properties of fat can be found. But the thing is, when we think about fat, we're also thinking about oil. Mm-hmm. And we need to think about the ways in which we view certain oils as being almost magical. I'm thinking here of like essential oils that you rub on your body that you use for aromatherapy. But I'm also thinking about the connoisseurship that goes along with olive oil today.
Right.
I mean, here in Lawrence a few months ago, we had a gourmet olive oil shop that opened up, and I just sort of chuckled because I thought, well, this is a good fat. This is a fat that people don't see as disgusting. This is a fat that they see as almost pure and virtuous, as the Italians view their extra virgin olive oil. And so this is a fat that's also described as the kind of thing that will fight bad fat. You know, good olive oil is seen as the kind of thing that can actually, you know, when used in moderation, will actually make you thinner. And so when we think about fat in the broadest sense of fats, lipids, oils, and other things like that, we can't even really say honestly today that we hate fat. It's a matter of which fat we're talking about. Is it fat in the body? Is it healthy fats? Is it saturated fats? Is it unsaturated fats? Is it olive oil? Is it Crisco? I mean, it goes on and on and on. So I think that even today we are ambivalent about fat. I don't think we simply hate it unless we're only talking about one particular version of fat.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you for your time today. That's KU history professor Christopher Forth. He's writing a forthcoming book titled Flab, A Cultural History of Fat. Chris, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks, Steve, for having me. I appreciate it.